Back in November, when a group of supporters of Missouri's minimum wage increase gathered on election night, the entertainment was spoken word poetry about paying bills.
Plus $100 late fee and pissed off landlord, plus emergency assistance, plus eviction notice, pick up light bill, throw gas bill higher in the air, throw payday loan repayment higher in the air, empty out bank account, plus overdraft on the empty account, plus $28 overdraft fee, plus overdraft on the empty account, plus $28 overdraft fee, plus right to cure notice on entire loan.
Proposition B to raise Missouri's minimum wage did end up passing that night. The idea is for minimum wage to go up incrementally from $7.85 an hour to $12 an hour between now and 2023. And the first raises of 2019 are going into effect right now. So how will this work? And will it change the scenario we just heard with bills piling up for low-wage workers? I'm Gina Kaufman. Let's start with someone who's been keeping a close watch on how minimum wage increases play out from state to state. Ben Zipperer is with us from the Economic Policy Institute in D.C. Good morning, Ben.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So first of all, can you explain what the deal is with these minimum wage increases happening at the state level? Because there is such a thing as a federal minimum wage.
Right. There is a federal minimum wage. So that's kind of the main law in this country for lifting wages at the bottom of the pay scale. And the federal minimum wage right now is about $7.25 an hour. Tipped workers earn less than that, but the kind of headline minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. But that $7.25 an hour, that stayed the same for almost the past 10 years now since the last federal minimum wage increase. So that's a long time of having a relatively low minimum wage to begin with, but then also one that hasn't kept pace with either the cost of living in this country as it's increased over the last 10 years, or as wages have increased over the last 10 years. And as a result, because that federal minimum wage hasn't kept pace with our economy, other states like Missouri, for example, and other localities like counties, cities, and other areas have been increasingly raising their minimum wages above that low federal minimum wage to account for the inaction at the national level.
So in Missouri, we are going from $7.85 an hour, as I mentioned, to $12 an hour, but we're getting there gradually. It'll go up 85 cents a year until it reaches that $12 mark in 2023. How does that compare with other states that are trying to do this? Is it pretty typical?
Yeah, so I'd say that the kind of the gradual schedule of increases, like you're talking about in Missouri, that also is fairly typical both at the national level, but also in other states. And the idea is that, there's a recognition that the minimum wage is too low, and that's why you're increasing it. But you actually want to do it in a predictable, gradual way so that it gives time for the economy, the labor market, employers and employees to adjust to those new higher wages.
Employers, I understand how they have to adjust. How do other people have to adjust to, like, making more money?
Oh, so yeah, that's a good point. It's not adjusting, but they, obviously as a worker, you want to have as fast an increase as possible. But you do want to accommodate, businesses' interests and in gradually adjusting how they hire workers at a given rate. Also, when you raise the minimum wage, other things happen throughout the economy. So, for example, when you raise the minimum wage there, restaurants, for example, one way that they pay for minimum wage increases is that they raise prices just a little bit on items that they sell. And so you would want that to be a more gradual process rather than to happen all at once.
So this gets to this question I have. I mean, in debates about minimum wage, you usually have two main arguments. There's the kind of all boats rise argument that the entire economy improves when everyone is staying afloat. But there's also this concern that, to offset the cost of paying people more, businesses have to charge more for products and services. So the argument goes they end up giving more with one hand, but kind of taking away with the other. Any credibility to either of these arguments based on what you've seen? Are both true, neither true?
I think both are true, but the kind of downsides are extremely small relative to the benefits. And in fact, sometimes there appears to be no downside really at all, or it's just too small to detect relative to the amount of wage gains that low-wage workers see. So the kind of big concern that you're talking about, maybe a more general one, is that, okay, so you're raising wages for low-wage workers. That means an employer, a business, is going to have to pay more for an hour of labor because you've raised the minimum wage. And as a result, they're going to hire fewer workers. And then the scare story goes is that, well, now workers are going to have fewer employment opportunities, and that's bad for low-wage workers. On the other hand, the other thing that happens that's missing from that story is that when you raise the minimum wage, you have made those low-wage jobs much more valuable and much better for low-wage workers. And as a result, it's easier for employers to recruit and retain workers at those jobs. So you've got two forces kind of like working in opposite against each other. One, there's kind of some reduction in hiring due to a higher minimum wage. And on the other hand, employers have to do less hiring because workers stay at their job longer. And it's easier to recruit workers because you're paying them more. And those kind of two factors kind of balance out so that there's not really much effect on overall employment when you raise the minimum wage. And in fact, mostly what you see is just large wage gains or significant wage gains for the workers that need it the most.
My question there, kind of like when you were talking about that 10 years is a long time to not raise the minimum wage, given how the cost of living goes up, et cetera, et cetera. When you think about that, it's going to take 4 years to get us up to $12 an hour. Do you worry that by the time 4 years have gone by, $12 an hour ceases to be enough?
Yeah, and I think you can make an argument, and especially in Missouri, that $12 an hour isn't going to be enough. So maybe one way to think about this is that, okay, so Missouri's raising its minimum wage to $12 an hour by 2023. And, over the next 4 years or so, the price of everything in the economy is going to go up, right? So prices for food, prices for fuel, prices for healthcare, that's just going to happen anyways. And so you worry that $12 is going to be eroded somewhat, and it will be. And the way to think about it is that probably by 2023, if you were to kind of translate that into today's dollars, that $12 minimum wage in 2023, that's going to be a little bit less than $11, probably about $10.80, $10.90, something like that. So that's the kind of minimum wage increase, translated to current cost of living conditions that Missouri is going to see. We're effectively raising the minimum wage in Missouri to something like $10.80 or $10.90 an hour.
Do these increases affect people making more than minimum wage already? Because if you're making, let's say, $8.50 an hour, that's more than $7.85. But according to a study from MIT, a single adult in Kansas City actually needs to make $11.05 an hour just to get by.
Yeah, definitely. So when you raise the minimum wage, so the new minimum wage in Missouri is going to be about $8.60 or so.
This year. Yeah, this year.
So, you have some workers who were already earning, let's say, like $9 an hour, right? So employers are not legally obligated to raise wages for those workers earning $9 an hour because they're already earning more than the Missouri minimum wage of $8.60. However, employers are going to raise wages for those workers anyways. And there's two reasons why. One is that, when you're working somewhere with other workers, employers try to maintain, a pay hierarchy that relates a rank that has some degree of fairness. And so if you are already earning like $9 or $10 an hour, and then because of the minimum wage increase, people who are earning, say, $7.80 an hour are now earning much closer to you, you're going to want a raise. And employers raise wages just above the new minimum to reflect that. The other thing that happens is that employers that you don't even work for will be raising wages in order to recruit you to their job. And that will cause them to raise minimum wages, raise wages like to $9 an hour, to $10 an hour. These kind of spillover, they're called spillover effects or ripple effects. They are something that we see really often after a minimum wage increase. And they go up, you know, usually about $3 or $4 above the actual minimum wage increase. So you should expect in Missouri that workers will be seeing wage increases, maybe a little bit smaller wage increases than the minimum wage increase, but nevertheless, some wage increases, probably up to about $12 an hour.
Okay, I'm going to get back to whether there are any unintended consequences of that. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Ben Zipperer. He's a national expert on minimum wage increases, and we're going to get back to him. But for now, let's hear from someone who is just now seeing her first paycheck increases as a result of Proposition B, which passed in Missouri back in November. Fran Marion is a line cook at Burger King. Hi, Fran.
Good morning.
Tell me your story. I guess let's start with what a line cook does.
A line cook, my current position is that I prepare all the sandwiches that are ordered by the paying customers.
And so let's look back. I mean, how much were you taking home per hour as of the end of 2018, just a few weeks ago?
As of a few weeks ago, I was taking home $9 an hour.
And how was that working for you just in your life?
Oh, it's a struggle. It's a struggle between... It's been a struggle making $9 between keeping housing over my kids' heads.
How many kids?
I have two kids. I have a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old. Keeping shelter, and it's even hard to the point to where I currently have no health care. So it's a big struggle.
Tell me about your housing situation.
I've been on the wages that I've made, I've been to the point to where we haven't had anywhere to stay, to the point that I've had my kids live across town and me live in another part of town and not being able to see them.
Can you talk to me about just some of the choices you've had to make with the income you have been bringing in? Just like, okay, I have X number of dollars. Mm-hmm. I can do A or I can do B.
I can pay my rent or I can go get my child the basic necessities that they need to survive. As far as, you know, we're raising a young lady, her necessity that she needs as a young woman, or stuff they need for school versus me paying my gas bill.
How do you deal with that?
I try to make the best decision possible as a parent, that would help benefit and help my children.
Can you share a little bit of your personal backstory? Like, What kind of education you've had and what kind of options you felt have been available to you?
My background, I went to a very prominent high school. I have some college background, but I couldn't afford to complete college because that means costing me hours out of my job, which is taking away from me taking care of my children.
Yeah. So as of January, you are seeing results from this minimum wage increase, right?
Yes, there are results being from the minimum wage increase.
So how much is your paycheck going up?
Right now I can tell you because again, I make $9, so I'm still above that 860 realm. So I don't know what mine would go up to as of this point.
So you're not sure what you're going to see?
No, ma'am.
Do you expect to see a raise or no?
I would love to see a raise.
What kind of difference do you think, how big of a raise would you need for it to really make a difference in your life?
I mean, we're fighting for $15 an hour, and that's just a step in the right direction.
And that's with Stand Up Casey. You're a member of that group.
Yes, I am. We're fighting for $15 an hour in a union. I mean, because according to MIT, like you said earlier, for one single person, it's $11.05. But for one parent and one child, it's $22 an hour. And then for a parent and two children, in my case, it's $28 an hour. So right now, we feel that $15 is a living wage. It's a step in the right direction.
What do you think? So you're saying you're fighting for $15 an hour, which is a little bit above the sort of end goal 4 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that 15 number come from? It is lower than what it would cost, according to this study, for you as a parent with two children.
Mm-hmm. It comes from doing research and us feeling that it's a good borderline 15 across the board for everybody.
Do you feel like those decisions that was hard decisions that you're currently making, that you might be still making some of those hard decisions at 15?
I mean, that is a possibility that it would be harder, but I think it would be less harder than now.
Well, we're going to be talking more with our expert guest, but what are your thoughts as you listen to him? Do you have questions about what he's been saying about how these kinds of gradual minimum wage increases like we're seeing in Missouri play out in other states that have had things like this?
I mean, all I can say is that with us fighting for 15, we won 15 in Seattle, New York, California, and we just won in St. Paul, Minnesota. So we know that it's possible, and it's a living wage for everybody.
Call 816-235-2888 with your story, whether you're a worker seeing a raise, an employer who's paying for one, or someone making more than $9 an hour, more than $12 an hour even, wondering how you stand to gain or lose. 816-235-2888 will bring our national expert back in on this discussion about Missouri's minimum wage increase when KCUR's Central Standard returns. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about the minimum wage increase in Missouri. Starting this year, minimum wage in the state is going up 85 cents a year from $7.85 an hour, with a cap at $12 in 2023. We've been hearing the story of a line cook at Burger King who is hoping to get a raise, and you can share your story at 816-235-2888. Fran Marion, welcome back.
Thank you.
So just over the break, you were telling me that your daughter is a senior this year.
Yes, my baby is a senior, and yes.
And that comes with some extra pressure on you.
Yes, senior dues are, wow, they're drastic. You know, but you only graduate once, so therefore there's going to come a time for me to pick my battle, you know. And she deserves to have the best graduation possible.
What are her thoughts about after graduation?
She's going to go to school for photography.
That's really exciting. How will that affect you and your family?
I'm hoping for her to get the scholarship. She's looking and weighing out her options. She's very intelligent, so she has a couple ways of deciding which way she wants to go.
Well, Fran Marion, stick around with me. I want to bring back Ben Zipper of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Ben, what do you hear in Fran's story?
I unfortunately think that's a really common story, that it is, we pay exceptionally low wages in this country, and it's really shameful. I mean, just to put this in a historical perspective, the highest kind of national minimum wage that we had after you accounted for cost of living changes over time was probably in the late 1960s. And today, our national minimum wage is about 25% lower than that. So 5 decades ago, we paid the lowest wage workers more than we pay them today, even though labor productivity, workers have gotten twice as productive, basically, over that time period. And that is just absolutely shameful. And so
why is it? What accounts for that change?
What accounts for that change is that we have unfortunately turned our back on the lowest wage workers in this country. And we have, even though, you know, there have been state increases that have been as bold as politically possible, maybe at that time, and there have been national increases that are very helpful. Unfortunately, we haven't done enough for low-wage workers so that they can actually maintain a adequate standard of living, just like your guest is talking about.
What I hear partly is the uncertainty of just not only just sort of big picture kind of uncertainty, but also uncertainty just about what the minimum wage increase is going to mean for her just in the immediate future. Is that typical?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's not exactly clear, just like what your guest was talking about, how her wages are going to be increased, you know, before the minimum wage becomes a binding, say, in the next year or so on $9 an hour. And that's a reflection of the fact that we pay people, especially in restaurants, but mostly in, you know, restaurants, retail, and other low-wage sectors of the economy, extremely low wages, such that even when we do see minimum wage increases, there are still quite a lot of people with low wages. I mean, just to put this in perspective, in Missouri, Missouri is enacting an important minimum wage increase, has enacted an important minimum wage increase, and it is going to meaningfully improve the lives of many people. And it's going to raise wages for, by the time it's fully phased in several years, but for nearly a quarter of the entire workforce. At the same time, many of those workers are still going to be unable to afford an adequate standard of living, especially if they're trying to raise a family.
So you did kind of hint at this earlier, but can you talk about the discrepancy between tipped versus non-tipped minimum wage?
Yeah, sure. So unfortunately, we kind of have a tiered structure in minimum wages in many places in this country. So in Missouri, for example, most workers will face, like you're describing, an $8.60 minimum wage. However, workers who earn tips, their employers are only required to pay them half of that in Missouri, so about $4.30 an hour this year. And as long as those workers earn enough tips in order to cover the difference between that $4.30 and the $8.60 standard, then that's all they're going to receive. And as a result of that, we kind of have like two tiers of labor markets in this country where a certain class of workers, tipped workers, who are overwhelmingly disproportionately people of color, disproportionately women, are only guaranteed lower wages from their employers. And as a result, kind of getting back to what you're talking about, their incomes are much more dependent on tips, which are, of course, highly volatile.
You know, I want to get to one of our callers. We've got a call from Murad in Independence who wants to share his story. And you can share yours, too, at 816-235-2888. We're talking about the minimum wage increase in Missouri. And we want to hear from you if it's affecting you, whether you're an employee or an employer. Murad in Independence, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on your show. I pointed out to the producer, I'm 56 years old, the late 70s, 78, 79, I worked right before I went to college. My rate of pay at the time had gone up from, I think, was 245 to like 265. So in 40 years, the minimum rate of pay for an employee has basically only gone up $5. Now, just take this in mind. At the time, you could buy a Big Mac for less than a dollar. Less than a dollar. Now, that's 400 times that amount of money for that same sandwich. You could buy a cheeseburger for 50 cents. Yeah, I know you can probably get them at the dollar menu now because it's the least expensive item on the menu. But this idea that phasing in part only happens when the employees are the ones who will benefit from it. But for everyone else, there's no phase into it. They simply raise the prices. So every time, as I've noticed over the years, every time that There was the idea that there might be a raise to minimum wage. The prices have already gone up. So we're never really gaining any ground.
You know, I want to hear from Ben Zipper on this. Ben, I mean, the argument that Murad is making is not particularly different from what you've been describing. And I wonder, is there a conversation about what maybe about other approaches than minimum wage increases or sort of in tandem adjustments that could make this cycle like, because it does seem like the cycle that you are describing makes it hard for a minimum wage increase to make a long-term difference.
So I think there's a lot of truth in what Murad the caller was saying. But I want to be clear that I don't think it's so much the fault of the minimum wage that's causing large price increases. Minimum wages do raise prices a little bit. But they really kind of pale in comparison to the benefit the workers receive. But at the same time, I think what's absolutely correct is that minimum wages in this country in general have not adequately maintained or increased workers' standard of living over, you know, longer time periods, just like we're talking about. Again, just to put it in a long-term historical perspective, you know, the late 1960s minimum wage was roughly about like $9 to $10 an hour. And now we have a national minimum wage that's much lower than that. And so that's a very clear instance of that, you know, once you account for cost of living. And so that's a very clear instance in which minimum wages have not kept up with the increase in prices in the economy. And that's a really strong argument, at least in my view, is why we need to actually have much bolder and larger minimum wage increases.
You know, I'm curious about whether the work market has changed in that time as well, just the labor force and who is doing minimum wage jobs and why, if that has changed.
That definitely has changed. I mean, your other caller, who is a cook, mentioned she has some college education. Workers over this time period, the lowest wage workers have become much more educated and much more productive over this time period. And so in principle, you know, if we actually had an economy that rewarded that across the entire spectrum of the labor market, those workers would be earning much more because they're much more productive and they have higher skills and more based on their education and their work experience. But now we don't have that kind of economy, unfortunately. And that's why, you know, increases in the minimum wage, especially bolder increases in the minimum wage than we've seen in the past, are absolutely necessary.
Fran Marion, you just told your story and you're listening to me and an economist talk about your story. I'm curious whether you have questions for this economist, like as you've sat here listening to this.
No, but with people, I was going back to listening to the caller and kind of analyzing what he was saying. You know, the economy steady growing and changing every day versus the low wage workers. There's no movement. It's a standstill. Right now, we're starting to make a step in the right direction. I mean, so, and I feel that with us getting that pay gap, we're able to put in into our economy and keep up with our economy. Right now, it's ahead of us, and our struggle is just, it's impossible.
You know, you're part of, we've mentioned this, you're part of Stand Up KC, which has been pushing for raises for fast food workers here in town. And I'm wondering, like, that obviously puts you in conversation with a lot of other people with a whole range, I'm guessing, of life situations. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what you've learned being part of this collective, this group?
I learned that I am one of 64 million low-wage workers that are out here struggling every day. I learned that I am not alone and that we have to keep on fighting until we win that living wage and that union.
Ben Zipper, I'm curious about the definition of a living wage.
Yeah, so I mean, they're, you know, like what makes up a living wage and how you would calculate something like that. Yeah, so there are various definitions. I mean, there's no one single definition, but kind of one concept that, you know, I'm an economist. I work for an organization called the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and my colleagues have developed what they call family budgets. And so these are the amount of wage income that you would need over the year as a family in order to have a modest but adequate standard of living, depending on how many adults are in your family, how many kids you have, and where you live, whether it's in Kansas City or Los Angeles. And what we try to do is we account for, you know, kind of local costs in that area, like housing, food, childcare if you have children, transportation, healthcare, you know, any other necessities, and taxes. And these are very conservative amounts because they don't leave any room for saving for either retirement or for emergencies or saving for your kids' college education, et cetera. And so even with, you know, to take Kansas City as an example, you know, sort of like what your caller was, your guest was saying earlier, you know, one adult with just no children, you'd need well over, you know, $33,000 a year in order to kind of meet an adequate but modest standard of living along these lines, which translates into basically a $15 an hour wage today.
You know,
and of course, if you had children, it would be much higher than that.
We have just talked. We've talked a lot about Fran's story, and Fran works in the fast food industry. Does this vary how it plays out from industry to industry in any significant way, or like
the
local versus or like local versus national businesses, how they fare in states where minimum wage is increased, as is happening now here?
Yeah. So I think So restaurants are one of the, you know, lowest wage sectors of the economy. They pay the lowest wages for a lot of workers. And so those are that kind of industry. Also, retail pays pretty low wages. Those are the kinds of industries where you're going to see the biggest wage increases due to a minimum wage increase. So in Missouri, those wages in retail and in restaurants, those are the industries that you're going to see probably the largest largest wage increases overall.
Economist Ben Zipper, line cook Fran Marion, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Keep talking to us about Missouri's minimum wage increase. We're at KCUR CST on Twitter. Up next, cyber defense is now something people do for fun, I guess. And K-State's Cyber Defense Club has national clout. That story when Central Standard returns. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. There is a cyber defense club at K-State, which is interesting in and of itself. But they recently took second place out of 70 teams in a national competition put on by the U.S. Department of Energy. Their task was to defend an energy company against professional hackers, and they were really good at it. So with a new semester starting up, we are joined by a student who was part of that big win for the team, and she's headed back to fight hackers once again in Cyber Defense Club. Brianne Anschutz, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you do in Cyber Defense Club?
Basically, what our club is we try and teach students kind of about cybersecurity, kind of pique their interest and help them kind of prepare to be a part of the industry if that's kind of the direction that they decide to take their degree from K-State. We do that through participating in cyber defense competitions like you mentioned earlier. The Department of Energy's Cyber Force competition was one of our most recent ones that we did rather well at. And then we also kind of in order to understand defense, you kind of have to understand the offense side as well. And so we have a virtual range, which is what we call an infrastructure we have set up that students can practice setting up different aspects of a network, as well as like set up something as their own personal test bed to kind of practice more of the offensive techniques to see how that looks from a defensive perspective.
So when did you, you're a senior, right?
Third year, graduating in May, yeah.
So when you arrived as a freshman, did you like walk down the hall and see a flyer that's posted on a wall that's like Cyber Defense Club and you're like, yeah, man, that's me. How'd it happen?
Well, for me, I started computer science having maybe written 10 lines of code before in my life. I had just kind of went to K-State thinking, okay, engineering sounds interesting. I had grown up on a farm, and so going over to the shop with my dad when I was little, I was always interested in how things worked. And when I was listening through all the programs, something just clicked with computer science, and so I went like that. And then I knew computer science overall was a very broad field, and I would need to find something that I'd want to kind of focus and specialize in. And I knew that coming from a small town, it's pretty much default that you're involved in a ton of things in terms of volunteering, that sort of thing. And so I ended up joining several clubs that year just to kind of get, like, kind of see what different areas were. And one of those was the Cyber Defense Club. I went in. Every year we have what we call the fire hose, which is where, like, you kind of just throw a ton of information in, like, one or two meetings at people to kind of get them, like, if they pick up little bits and pieces, it kind of gets them the bare bones needed to be able to kind of move further in kind of what we would either present or, like, some of the projects we would encourage them to do. And so in that, it was like everything was going over my head, but I knew that it might not make sense this time around, but maybe the next time around it will. And so I just kept going, and it started being really interesting for me when I participated in the open house display that we put on my freshman year. I kind of helped with that, and then that's what really kind of piqued my interest. And then after that, I ran for safety and ethics officer, which is one of only three elected positions, and got that last year.
I'm going to need you to back up and explain kind of, I mean, I know you kind of explained what you do in Cyber Defense Club, but as like a non-computer science major, I don't totally understand. I mean, what's the clubbiness in this? Because it still sounds a lot like homework.
It could kind of be seen like that. It's a lot of people that, like, you find something you really enjoy, like, say, you really enjoy sewing, so you, like, go home and you have a sewing project you work on. That's the same thing for us, only instead of having a sewing project we work on, it's something that we're super passionate about and really enjoy, and so we spend our free time working on cybersecurity stuff.
So, like, you practice ways to fight off hackers?
Kind of, yeah. Practice how to, like, set up a system securely so that hackers maybe can't get in right away.
I'm picturing, like, reality TV style challenges, like they're gonna take down your multinational firm unless you stop them from getting into like thousands of email accounts in 5 minutes. Go. Is that what it's like?
Some competitions are more like that. The way, I guess I haven't really explained how competitions, the defensive competitions, typically work. Basically, you're given a vulnerable network that, like, already has holes built into it that attackers could easily exploit and get into the system if there was no one working on it. And you're given a time frame. Sometimes it's a couple weeks, like with the case of the Department of Energy's competition. Sometimes it's a couple minutes, as is the case of some others. And sometimes the attackers start at the network with not a lot of knowledge. At the same time, you start trying to figure out your network to try and defend it.
So when I understand that in this competition you just did, there were professionals who you were trying to outsmart. But in your club, when you're practicing, who plays the hacker? Is that other club members?
Other club members, and sometimes it's more like just learning, and then you kind of just, it's something that quite often we learn the offensive side of, oh, that's why you do that. At competition, one thing we learned, I remember a story of some of the more senior members that, like, they talk about how they learned how cron job was a thing.
It's basically a
thing that runs on a Linux operating system that repeats a command every so often. And so, say, every time you turn on your computer, it, like, tells you you've been hacked and flashes that. Like, for a really simple example, pops open a terminal, which is, like, the typical thing you picture when you think of a hacker on, like, the, like, hacker in media sort of thing, where they've got the thing running that, like, has random numbers, kind of like the Matrix, those sort of things.
Yeah.
Or, like, they're typing commands, and that's called a terminal. And so a really simple one, an example of that would be something that every time you reboot it, it runs a command to pop one of those open. And it was a lot more complex than that, but, like, they were trying to figure out, why is this thing coming back every single time? And they didn't figure that out until usually after these competitions, they have what they call a red team debrief, which is where the attackers come in and kind of explain how they got into your stuff, that sort of thing, to really make it an awesome learning opportunity, even if you, like, didn't come out on top, anything like that. And so in that particular one, they came out, they talked about that, and then, like, as they mentioned that, we wrote it down, like, looked it up later and figured out what it was. And so sometimes we learn stuff after the fact, after we've been exploited by it.
But it also really sounds like, and we know this, but it's funny to think about it in the college setting. If you want to outsmart hackers, you have to learn how to hack. So that's why businesses are often, and even the government, they turn to former hackers who have been apprehended and turned themselves around and are now upstanding citizens, and they use those skills that once exploited networks to defend them. But if you want to outsmart hackers, you have to learn how to hack. That means that you are at college learning how to hack.
Yeah, but within our club, we really have a lot of strict stuff about the ethics behind hacking. At our first meeting every single year, the safety and ethics officer, or at least early on in the year, they give up, and usually this position is kind of designed for like someone not like a senior yet, and so this is something that it's also a really awesome learning opportunity for them, but they have to get up in front of the entire club and basically go through explaining, like, okay, so if you do this without explicit written permission, here are all the laws you break. If you do something bad, we will not be helping your defense. We will be helping the prosecution, saying, yes, we did indeed teach you how to do this, and that sort of thing. So we're very strict on the, you get your explicit written permission you need to be able to learn those sort of offensive techniques legally and ethically, and just make sure to keep yourself on the up and up, because in this industry, that's what you need, really, to be able to get the kind of fun jobs that a lot of us would like.
Fun jobs like what? Like being hired by a company to do this for real.
Yeah, like being a part of like an internal red team, or being a consultant as a part of an external red team.
They're called red teams. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that's kind of the common vernacular, at least that I've always heard it called. Is kind of red team is the offensive side, and then blue team is defenders.
So this is a sport like soccer.
Yeah, kind of like that. So there's both sides, and I know in a lot of companies it's becoming very popular to actually have internal red teams, where they're just constantly trying to break into their own company's network just to kind of keep the blue team or the defenders on their toes, so that they maybe are constantly trying to search for their own company's red team, but then they might be able to pull out and find something else that's like maybe an actual attacker.
So if we're thinking about this like a sport, like soccer, we've heard about a couple of the skills you have to have, like coding is one skill, and you have to be able to learn that offensive red team, like hacking skill, basically. But what else do you have to learn? Because if you think about the soccer analogy, you have to dribble the ball. You have to be able to get the ball away from someone else. You have to work on your speed as a runner. You should probably practice headers. What are some of the different skills cyber defenders need?
I would say the biggest one is the ability to stay calm when something major is going on. Like in our case with Argon, we realized that we had an issue with our website that.
I just want to clarify. This is the national competition you were just in that was put on by the U.S. Department of Energy. You were defending an energy company by the name of Argon. Go on.
Argon is the national lab we were competing at.
Gotcha. Okay.
So we had an issue with the website we were given, and we realized it had a way that attackers could have gotten in and been able to run malicious code on our system. And so we had to be able to react very calmly and very quickly to resolve that issue. And so that was something that we definitely had to be able to think calmly, think rationally. And then I guess another really important skill is the ability to just start in with something that you have no clue about and just delve in, search all sorts of resources to try and learn as much as you can about something, even if you 2 weeks ago didn't even know what that thing was.
And that's real life. That's not just college, right? Because new threats emerge and you're in that situation. You're a professional, but yet you know nothing about this.
Yeah. Yeah, completely.
Well, what was it like to compete in this way? I mean, 70 colleges with teams like yours getting together, sponsored by a government agency, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah. It was a really awesome experience. It has grown every year. We've went for the past 3 years, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. The first year, it was just at Argonne National Lab. Last year, it was up to 35 teams, I believe. And they added a few additional labs, and then they just keep growing and growing every year. And it's just really awesome to see like the different ideas different teams come up with, the way they kind of do different things, and just kind of the camaraderie of, like, yes, we did not really sleep the night before, but we're doing this because we love it.
So this is like up all night in a lab kind of competition?
Yeah, yeah. With this competition, we ended up realizing at about 9:30 the night before that we had to have a web-facing ability to interact with one of the services that we were given. It was a high-performance computing cluster that was supposed to imitate basically like a supercomputer, only made with Raspberry Pis, which are really small, like very low-powered computers that you can get for like $35.
So these are not pastries?
Yeah.
Okay, you just really had my interest, like seriously, with the Raspberry Pis. Go on. Well, you know, actually, you got second place out of 70 teams. What do you think set your team apart?
I think for us, what really helped is having a lot of team members who have been at this competition for multiple years. Like, I know over half the team, that was their second time competing at that competition. And we had, I believe it was only one, but one member who it was their third time at that competition. And so we kind of understood, like, how the rule docs are written out, that sort of thing. The type of documentation that the white team, which is, I guess if you go back to the soccer analogy, the officials, the way that they like their documentation written, we have that kind of built up for ourselves now.
So
it's kind of the institutional knowledge and that sort of thing, as well as several people on the team who, besides being really good defenders, are also very good at being offensively minded.
Well, so that it sounds like, though, K-State to be one of the longest competing teams in this, that you guys are kind of at the forefront of this.
I think so, since we joined the competition. I think at that point it was only in its first or second year. So it really, I think, has helped a lot.
Well, Brianne Anschutz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brianne is with us from K-State in Manhattan. She is on K-State's cyber defense team, which just took second in a national competition put on by the U.S. Department of Energy. Go Wildcats. That's a wrap for today's show. You can listen back to anything we discussed at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we archive all our past shows. So if there is anything that you're bummed that you missed, never fear, you can still listen. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, how the government shutdown is affecting regular people here in town. If we should be telling your story as part of that show, reach out to us. We are at KCURCST on Twitter or email us centralstandard@kcur.org. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Suzanne Hogan, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Thanks to KCUR's Samuel King for helping us out today. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.